But what you need to provide the patient and the family are the resources so that when they recognize what is normal for them and any deviation from that norm is suspicious, then they know where they can go for help.
I'm Christiana Facey Crowther, and I'll be your nurse. And today I'm joined by Catherine Cazell. I met Catherine when I was brand new to nursing, and she was in a leadership position at the time and approaching the end of a career that spanned 4 decades. She was the best clinical leader that I have ever encountered. I only got to see her in action for a couple of years, but she was a mentor to me, and I tried to get involved with whatever she was doing. I was fresh, full of energy, like, let's tackle all the problems. Not only did I admire her for her depth of knowledge, but looking back, I recognize how skillful she was in guiding me and tempering some of my idealism or ignorance without ever dampening my enthusiasm, and that's a tricky balance. I think that new nurses bring fresh energy and vigor, and we rely on our experienced leaders to skillfully channel and sustain that. Without the benefit of wise leaders, I think much of that energy and potential goes unrealized. Catherine is now happily retired, and she welcomed me and my recording equipment into her living room in London, Ontario. And we talked while her big yellow lab napped on the carpet. What made Catherine such an effective clinician and leader, I think, really comes through in this conversation. This is a woman who gets stuff done. Catherine sees opportunity where others don't and has the courage to try things. Her orientation to the patient and family's needs becomes clear when we discuss some clinical scenarios. I've directly taken some of the language she shares here and applied it in my own practice over the past couple of months. And I must say that it has been very helpful. I think a little refresh on the old repertoire sometimes just opens a new door or offers a new way of connecting with people. As a leader, Catherine mixed high expectations for clinical care. I mean, she wrote a lot of the standards, with respect for the people providing it and a willingness to get in there, address the details, and support the work. She could inspire people to believe that change is possible, to put in the extra effort to learn and try something new, and she provided the education to make that happen, and she used her leadership position to adapt the systems to enable and sustain the change. And this, I believe, is what we all need from our leaders. When I think of an innovator, of a leader, I think of the people like Catherine. And I hope that in this conversation, you'll benefit, as I have, from a quick visit with her wonderful mind.
Catherine Cazell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Just to begin, can you briefly describe your career in nursing and where your inspiration came from to develop your specialty as a wound ostomy continence nurse?
Mm-hmm. Many, many years ago... I graduated from the University of Windsor. I had no idea what I wanted to do. Months away from graduation, I had no idea. I liked every area. As it happened, a friend of mine in the class said to me that there was a nursing agency in Toronto, St. Elizabeth Visiting Nurses at the time, were offering a graduating student a bursary of $1,000 and guaranteed 1 year employment.
So you did it for the money.
So I did it for the money, right. She said to me, go ahead, try it. Go. You have nothing to lose. I said, right. I have nothing to lose, everything to gain. And it was the kickstart, really. So I applied and I got it. So next thing you know, I'm working in Toronto. But that critical moment in terms of remaining a community nurse versus looking at another area of community nursing, let's say a specialty. That never occurred to me either until I visited. She was a young mother, 2 children, And I went to visit her because she had had a colostomy for a perforated diverticulum. And long story short, about 3 weeks later, I got word that she had committed suicide. And she committed suicide in the home garage before her children and husband came home. What was conveyed to us was that she never could accept the colostomy. Her husband could not accept the colostomy. She kept it from her children. She was in such agony, struggling psychologically. She felt she couldn't be a mother. She couldn't be a wife. She couldn't function as the keeper of the house. She was dirty. And apparently those were the words that were conveyed, that she was a dirty person. So therefore, her role was gone. So she committed suicide. I just kept asking the question, why? How did we miss that? And aside from how did we miss those cues that she was in such distress, I then asked the question, you know, like, what was it about this ostomy that was so debilitating? She was the second patient I had ever been exposed to who had an ostomy. My first was in year two in the BSCN program. And then nothing after that. And we certainly didn't have ostomy education the way we try to promote it now in the nursing curriculum. So it was that moment that I just wanted to be part of that, I'll say, world, that knowing more about ostomy, but knowing about it so that I could help others. I no sooner say this to you now, and I'm reminded that then there was a second patient on our roster within our own team who committed suicide. There was another patient, and that happened about 3-4 months later. And it was a gentleman, and he couldn't stand it as well, and came home and had brought actually home from his workplace some type of chemical that he swallowed. He died. He succumbed to that. And again, because he had an ostomy. So so critical moments that completely turned me around and allowed me to focus. So fortunately in our agency, there was an enteral stomal therapy nurse, and she was going on mat leave. So before she left for mat leave, I made it my business to learn as much as I could from her. And then the agency, recognizing that I was interested, they asked if I would go to Buffalo, to Roswell Park Memorial Institute in Buffalo, which is a cancer center, and to take the program so that when my colleague went on mat leave, I would assume the role. And that's exactly how it happened. I lived in a little smoky hotel in Buffalo.
Oh, nice.
Watched to the Institute for classes, and that was for 3 months. But then, back then, the education focused predominantly on ostomy. And about 5-10% of our curriculum focused on pressure sores at the time.
Yeah.
Pressure sores and nothing else. So there was the theoretical component and the clinical component. A final examination, that was it. So I came back as an enterostomal therapist and worked for the agency.
And then you continued in home care?
I continued in home care for 3 years, developing educational programming, some patient education. I didn't know what a master's was going to do for me at that point, but I knew that I wanted it. So I applied and came back to London here and completed my master's in nursing.
And this was in the 80s?
Yes, yeah, okay. It was in the 80s. Let me see, that was in 84. In 84, yeah. It was in nursing education at the time.
Mm-hmm. And then what role did you take on after that?
Aha, so there again, it's opportunities that come knocking. I think my career trajectory has always been with somebody knocking at the door. One of my colleagues in the class, again, knew that I was an enteral stomal therapy nurse
and asked if I would provide a in-service or a presentation to nursing grand rounds here at St. Joe's in London. Mm-hmm. I said, sure, I could do that. Little did I know that the director of surgery was in the audience. And between my friend, who served as a surgical nurse educator, and then the director of surgery, I guess they talked. And my friend Carol later came to me and she said, watch for an advertisement, a job advertisement in the paper, just in case you're interested. Well, the timing was perfect because I was graduating from the master's program. And there again, I didn't quite know what I was going to be doing. And so I saw the advertisement, applied, and got the position. I remained at St. Joe's for 21 years as the enterostomal therapy nurse, clinical nurse specialist there for surgery.
So doing that, did you provide direct patient care?
Yes.
Yeah.
Always.
Okay.
Always. Always, always, always. That was the only way I could keep my clinical skills up. And a year later, the title changing to clinical nurse specialist, that allowed me to assume those other hats that was in the literature then about what clinical nurse specialists were doing or should be doing in terms of consulting, providing patient direct care, being an educator, being a researcher. So it really opened up the doors for that and allowed me to do that. Also allowed me to open up the first outpatient clinic for ostomy care in the area.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Through the hospital?
Yes.
And
yes.
That was, and who staffed that? Like, was it you and?
Me. It was just me. It was every Wednesday afternoon. And we planned it so that my clinic was running the same time either one of the GI surgeons was there or one of the GI medical physicians. So that if there was a moment that I needed that physician consult, a second pair of eyes, even perform a procedure that was certainly outside my scope, then I was able to call on them. The other beauty of that was that we were all team members, and it was a beautiful example of interdisciplinary working with the physicians working with a clinical nurse specialist, and each of us respecting our roles and our skills, but it all came together beautifully on those Wednesday afternoons, and I just loved it. Just loved it.
Yeah. And you had a role kind of in the development of the specialty itself beyond your work at the hospital?
Certainly at St. Joe's, because I was the first one to develop the role there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess helping other nurses who were interested in either becoming an enterostomal therapy nurse. I had many students come and did their clinical experience with me in that capacity. And later, you know, becoming a full-fledged member of our professional association, the Canadian Association for Enterostomal Therapy at that time, which is now known as Nurses Specialized in Wound, Ostomy, and Continence Canada. Through that and the many roles that I had in that association, I entered a time in Canadian enterostomal therapy nursing development from, you know, the pea that was growing up to full-fledged, where now the majority are all, you know, minimum required is bachelor's of nursing. Many have gone on now to obtain their master's, and we have many more nurses obtaining their PhD. So it really has evolved over a 35, 40-year period, you know. And yeah, so to be part of that has been pretty, pretty exciting. So there's been a lot of change.
Can you just describe a little bit for us how the role of enterostomal therapy came to be,
mm-hmm.
and how that, obviously with the advances in surgical techniques and mm-hmm. the increased number of stoma surgeries mm-hmm. being performed, mm-hmm. as well as the development of some of the technology to manage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, stoma therapists in North America, it really began in the United States, and we're looking in the 1950s. And anybody who helped somebody else who had an ostomy, in fact, was a former patient. So individuals who had an ostomy were trained by a physician, and they became, I'll say, glorified visitors at first, and then later took on some hands-on experience, but all based on their own personal experience. Those were the first people known as enteral stomal therapists. In the 60s, early 70s, with the expansion of clinical knowledge, increasing surgical technique, how do we manage peristomal complications and so on, it was recognized that the lay person needed more. And so therefore, it was really nursing who then assumed, I'll say, that responsibility. Mm-hmm. So enteral stomal therapists then had to be an RN. So this was evolving in the United States. We had a few interested RNs in Canada who went to the States, primarily the Cleveland Clinic, went to the States to obtain their training, and they would come back as enteral stomal therapists. So we went from lay individuals in the 50s to RNs in the 60s, and in the early 70s into 80s, we again continued to see a transition from RN to then a degree nurse, a bachelor's in nursing or a bachelor's of science in nursing. In Canada, that was evolving the same way, but certainly not as quickly. And it was, I believe, somewhere in the early or late 90s, where in Canada we were having discussions where the registered nurse had to obtain a bachelor's of science in nursing in order to be an enteral stomal therapy nurse. So that is fairly recent. In Canada also, and I think in the States as well, we had nurses who, well, the registered practical nurse or the RNA, the registered nursing assistant, could be an enteral stomal therapist at that time as well. But that changed. That all changed to that it had to be a registered nurse in order to fulfill that capacity.
Is that resulting from the complexity of managing stomas?
And the clinical science, the knowledge base. In terms of the decision-making, being able to recognize something, being able to act upon it. So, yeah. So as science knowledge evolved, certainly the demand then for the role and the academic preparation evolved as well. So,
do you have a sense of why that became part of the nursing scope rather than, for example, the physician scope?
I think, just bluntly said, the surgeons were responsible for the surgery, and the care and the management came under the auspices of the registered nurse.
I think that's pretty well said.
You know, but there certainly is a collaboration there, and I think that continues to evolve as well, right? The collaboration between physician and the nurse specialist. But that's how it evolved in terms of enteral stomal therapist, enteral stomal therapy nurse. Mm-hmm. And now we have, in 2019, nurses specialized in wound ostomy incontinence care.
How do you become accredited to be a specialist nurse in wound ostomy incontinence?
In Canada, our association, the NSWOCC, has a program. BSCN is the minimum requirement. And the program is academic, and it comprises of three domains, and those are our practice domains: ostomy, wound management, and continence. So there are three distinctive courses for each of those domains. Mm-hmm. You must pass all of them in order to take the final exam to be a graduate of our Canadian school.
Okay.
In 2008, 2006, our association campaigned vigorously with the Canadian Nurses Association to recognize enterostomal therapy nurses as nursing specialists in that practice.
Why was that seen as being so important?
We as association first recognized that the amount of education and the clinical expertise involved truly was a specialty, especially when it expanded to those three domains of ostomy, wound incontinence. In order to be a specialist, you do have to have the training. You have to have the academic training. You have to have the knowledge. You have to have the clinical expertise. You have to be able to judge what you're doing and why you're doing it and so on. There are many other educational opportunities available to all professionals. So that said, there are a lot of opportunities to learn more about ostomy care and wound care. They could be a conference. They could be a two-day workshop. Unfortunately, those types of programs are valuable. They enrich the knowledge base of that particular registered nurse. But that doesn't make them a specialist. You have to have in-depth knowledge. You have to put in the clinical hours. You have to know the critical thinking and the decision-making and looking at nursing diagnoses relevant to your particular practice and being able to know the plethora of interventions that are available, but then being able to pick out those interventions that are going to be applying to that one particular case. So it was important to protect that knowledge base, to protect that clinical practice, to protect the patients and their families. Because there have been moments, there have been episodes where someone may have been consulted by someone less knowledgeable, and unfortunately, negative outcomes have occurred. Right. So again, I go back to it was a way of being able to protect the practice, legitimize the practice, but ultimately to protect the patient. Right? Ultimately to protect the patient, providing the best care possible, you know, for the patient and the family members.
Now, I've often wondered why, I mean, it kind of makes sense to me, but why specifically wound and ostomy go so closely together, mm-hmm. and why those two, and continence,
yeah.
and why those things seem to make sense to be combined as a specialty rather right. than separated.
Yeah, and you're very, very close to answering the question because the common denominator is skin. Going back some history-wise, in terms of where it started to, where the practice started to assume sort of the wound component, sadly, the Vietnam War. And nurses in the field and nurses back in the United States who were enterostomal therapists and managing ostomy and some of the catastrophic casualties that were coming back. Yes, many ostomies, but these nurses were also being now referred to, well, you can manage somebody's bowel on the outside and associated skin, acute skin and chronic wound circumstances. You can do other things. So it was through that actual, unfortunate war and using the expertise that they thought had, these nurses had, again, related to skin, that they started bridging over toward acute care wounds, managing that. And then those individuals who unfortunately may have had spinal cord injuries went on to develop pressure sores, as they were known back then, or pressure ulcers, now called pressure injuries, pressure-related injuries. They're now being asked to oversee these types of chronic wounds.
Oh, I see.
All right. So again, the common denominator is skin. So when I did my training, I mentioned that last sort of 5 or 10%, I had a couple classes on pressure ulcers. That was it. Anything that I learned beyond that as the years began to unfold and the association began to take on more and more, we were being referred to because of skin. Well, we had to keep up with all of that expertise. So our knowledge base began to expand. So from pressure-related injuries, pressure ulcers, we then were bridging over toward leg ulcers. So venous ulcers, diabetic ulcers, arterial ulcers. Some areas, some of our colleagues were brought in on burns, but that was another specialty, so we really didn't, you know, go into that. And then related to the continence, again, primarily, it was skin injuries related to incontinence, be it urinary or fecal incontinence. But there again, those who were interested in that began to ask the question, well, why the continence? What can I do about the continence? I'm managing skin. That's after the fact. But what can I do about the continence? So again, it evolved and the third specialty landed on the table. And next thing you know, the curriculum was being developed so that our nurses were being educated in continence and the types of. So it's just, again, it goes, I would say it goes back to the common denominator is skin and being able to use the principles of skin management plus ostomy, plus acute wounds and chronic wounds, plus continence care and skin management.
Interesting how so much of nursing history seems to harken back to wars, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Good old Florence.
And good old Florence. Right.
I know you were part of a number of committees developing best practice guidelines for our Registered Nurses Association here in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And you worked on specifically the ostomy one I wanted to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
So with your depth of knowledge, I hope I can ask you some questions related to clinical care that sometimes come up for me in my own practice. Mm-hmm. So I think some of the challenges that come from working with patients with a new ostomy, or even an ostomy that they've had for a while, when you see them in the hospital setting, is trying to prioritize the information to provide within the short time span that is available with the pressures to discharge early, etc. Mm-hmm. How do we talk to patients who are sometimes reluctant to engage with their stoma, they're feeling anxious? You described some of the psychological effects of a new stoma that can have on patients and their families. But at the same time, it's also, I understand, important to talk to them about the potential complications that can occur.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what are those complications? Why is it important to talk about them? And how do you approach that patient to have that conversation?
Wow. You're throwing me right back to the clinical bedside. And I'm going to draw on my own personal practice of what I can remember. I think it's important for any patient. They are a learner. They are a new learner. They're a patient first, yes, but they are a new learner. And what they are going to be learning is probably one of the most important things that they're ever going to learn for a moment in their life, or it might be for lifelong, and that is life with an ostomy. Or as the new PBG says, you know, anticipating or living with an ostomy. I always began, and I think it's absolutely important, couple of things, and I don't want to get into building the trusting relationship and all of that, but I think it's absolutely essential to know exactly where the patient / learner is at with respect to what they know. So whether it's you've already given them preoperative information, there has to be follow-up as to what their understanding of that information is. If they haven't touched it, they haven't looked at it, then you start at ground zero. Then you say, okay, Christiana, what do you want to know first? And I can say this openly in my clinic, you know, I would say, what do you want to know first? Before I give you my story of what I think you need to know, I want to hear from you first. What's your understanding of what you're going to have? What's your understanding of the ostomy? What do you want to know? I always started that way. Because eventually they would say, well, I learned this and somebody told me this. And that gave me something to work on. Some would say, don't want to know nothing. Don't want to know nothing, thank you. Not a thing. And I'd say, really? You don't want to know anything about what's going to happen? No. If it happens, it happens. And if it does, I'll just deal with it later. That sets the stage for which way to go. And somebody who wants to know and they've done their homework, fine. You can just kind of jump in and then you can start going through your repertoire with them. Those who are less wanting to know, yeah, that's when your role has to be, I believe, just a bit more directive, watching for all those little subtle nonverbal cues as to whether you've hit a scary moment. But to be able to say to them, this is what's going to happen. No flowers, by the way. No flowers. Just very straightforward. This is what's going to happen. This is what's going to look like. Stop, reassess where they're at, and keep going.
I think that is such a relevant point that you bring up. Sometimes in the pressured environment, we have it in our mind. We're going to tell this patient. We go in the room, and we start in. But just take the time to remember, let's assess the patient's knowledge first, you know. Let's see what they have to say.
Well, I think it's just so fundamental. I mean, if I was in the learning mode, and I have been in the past year, you know, having had orthopedic surgery and not being asked the question, well, what do you know about your surgery? Nope. I was bombarded with sheets of papers, foiled booklet, documents for this, documents for that, and they sat down and they just went through it. And I just sat there and I looked totally bored. And yeah, that's not the way to go.
No.
Yeah, it's not our agenda.
No.
It's the patient's agenda. It's the family's agenda. There have been many times where the most I was able to do was just show the appliance, show the ostomy device. That's it. Yeah. Maybe I got them to touch it. That's it.
So let's say you have a patient who is relatively receptive, and they're starting to get on their way, and they're touching it, and they're participating with appliance changes, and they're starting to be able to teach back what they've learned, and they've sort of got their appliance managed, and they seem open to the idea, and now it's time to start to take the conversation to the next level around, how are you going to manage your skin? Because I understand that complications in the community of people and their peristomal skin are relatively common, leakage, things like this. How do we share that information with patients? What is important to share with them related to monitoring their own skin and when to take action?
I think it begins the moment you conduct the first system change with your patient. It's not a matter of just going through the mechanics. It's going with the mechanics as well as describing every action that you are taking. I'm cleaning the skin now, and that's really important because you want to remove all of the sticky residue. You want to remove some stool, some bowel movement there that may have leaked or urine, and you keep talking and talking and talking. Passive learning. It's happening. They don't recognize it, but it is happening. And you're getting close to a discharge, and you're prepping them now for, you know how to remove it, you know how to clean your skin very well and pat dry. Then you have to introduce, I believe, what they now call essential life skills. I know that the hospitals are being challenged with shortened lengths of stays. They've been challenged for probably 20, 15 years on shortened lengths of stay. But from my perspective, and I think when we identify essential skills, we have to be thinking of self-management, successful self-management, confident self-management. So in wanting to achieve that with the patient, for the patient, so the patient can do it himself or herself, we need to help them identify what are the most critical of the complications. Because when you look at the 2019 PBG, there's pages of appendices there of a host of complications. That's not all going to happen to the patient within 24 hours or 48. Those are a combination of short-term and long-term potential complications. But for the patient who's going home, what do they need to know as those immediate? Could be stomal necrosis. There could be a change in the integrity, the viability of that stoma, and that's really important for them to know. If their appliance is leaking, yeah, within a short period of time, you can develop some redness to the skin, some soreness to the skin.
Itching,
burning, the redness, macerated skin from chronic leakage, and you get the epithelial tissue that becomes super hydrated and
whitish.
Whitish, that's right. So I think it's prudent as clinicians to be able to provide education to those most immediate possible complications. And I think I only listed probably two or three.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything after, I am hoping that the system provides follow-up. So that during that time period, the person's stoma remains viable, no longer a complication. Their stoma has been resized, eliminated the probability of leakage. It's those follow-up appointments or a telephone call that's really important to help educate, prepare the patient for maybe those medium range and long-term range complication. And you're not going to be able to do it all.
No.
The reality is, we weren't doing it 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't doing it 10 years ago. Because you can't. It's not going to happen. But what you need to provide the patient and the family are the resources so that when they recognize what is normal for them, and any deviation from that norm is suspicious, then they know where they can go for help. Ideally, it would be back to their nurse who specializes in wound ostomy incontinence,
mm-hmm.
right? Or going back to the hospital, getting in touch with an outpatient clinic there. There are resources online. But to answer your question again, going back to the essential skills that those individuals need to go home, those probable complications within the first 24, 48 hours, it might be the first week or the first 2 weeks until that person is able to come back for a follow-up.
I think that's a great key message. Figure out what your baseline is, what's normal for you, and any
Absolutely.
Deviation, act on that.
That's right.
And prevent it from yes. getting worse.
That's right. Absolutely. And so it is essential for them to know what is normal for them.
Because when it comes to all of the, I think, you know, we can't tell patients everything, and it's
no.
too much. They're learning about changes in their diet, changes in their showering, changes in the way they dress, changes in the way that they monitor
mm-hmm.
their fluid intake, all of these things. It's a lot of information.
And let's not forget the psychological component,
mm-hmm.
the emotional component. There never seems to be enough time for that.
No.
Never seems to be enough time for that. As I said to you in the opening, with those two patients in the community who committed suicide. Wow. Like, really?
Yeah.
Even with nursing coming into the home, something, you know, they didn't know that they could turn back to us and ask for help.
So how did that change the way that you engage with your patients about there? Because, I mean, that's a really, that drives the point home for you in a very personal way.
Mm-hmm.
So did you integrate that as part of your routine practice with patients, creating the space for that?
Always. It wasn't that I sat there and took a quality of life checklist type of thing.
No.
And checked it off. In order to prepare myself, there was a psychologist that I accessed. I brought Jack on board onto the team. And with him and through him, I learned a lot about engaging people into speaking about their gut responses, how they were feeling, the fears and so on. So much so that Jack and I developed a support group within the hospital that we invited our patients about 2 months after surgery to join. And so that ongoing exposure heightened the importance for me that as I'm helping the individual change their appliance, I'm also saying to that individual, how are you feeling doing this now, 2 months later, all by yourself? When you look at your stoma, what are you seeing? How are you feeling? Have you allowed your wife to help you with this if the need has come up? It just becomes part of that conversation. Bringing the other family members in is always a key thing as well. How did they feel about looking at their partner with the ostomy? And, you know, I can remember some responses to this day. You know, like, I've not been able to look at him at all. If he's in the shower now, I don't go into the shower at all. No,
wow.
I can't look. And then there are some where, no problem. Sometimes he just tells me, get out of the way because, you know, my hands are all over it too and I want to be helping as much as I can. So there's such a wide range of responses. And again, there's no right or wrong. But I think what was important too as a clinician is sensing when I felt that there was something really disturbing that I knew I wouldn't be able to handle because I didn't have the education, I didn't have the preparation. And I knew that I would have to refer that person on. And that happened. Certainly it happened. But it was being able to recognize it. And then there are some people who just sail through it.
Yeah, those people.
Sail through it and think, wow, really? Oh, honey, I've had worse things than this, right? This is nothing. I can deal with this. Okay, great. But then there are those who can't.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly believe it's in our role as a nurse specialist. I believe it's in anybody's role who comes in contact with a patient who has had ostomy surgery to be really in tune. I mean, really in tune with what the person is saying, how they're looking, the nonverbals.
Or sometimes that statement of, oh, I don't need to do it here. I know when I get home, I'll be just fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you learn that it hasn't been fine.
No.
And it's been weeks that they've, you know, looked at their system and, you know, then the spouse or whatever will say, yeah, no, just sat there and just let the pouch fill up and fill up and fill up. And I had to eventually empty it because they wouldn't touch it. So, yeah, those are issues.
In terms of pouches and appliances, mm-hmm. I mean, there's just seems like there's almost just a plethora of types of
supplies,
a massive amount.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had any involvement with the development of any of the technology?
Yeah.
Or, yeah?
Yeah, I have. I've had the opportunity to sit on a couple of the boards. Well, three of the major companies, anyway. It's fun. It's really fun because it's, first off, you're meeting colleagues nationally and internationally. So it's a richness of minds and experiences from different countries. What works for us doesn't work for someone in the UK, doesn't work for somebody in Germany, somebody, you know, living in southern United States. Because products are different. Products are designed differently. And some work better in colder weather, some work better in warmer weather. But having the opportunity to sit with minds at a table, and then you bring in the engineers and the chemists, and you start working with all of these products, and then they throw you, like you're at a kid's party, and they throw you a tray of all this stuff, and they say, okay, develop your most ideal product. Next thing you know, within a 3, 4, at most 5-year time, you are seeing a product that you helped develop. So why are there so many? Because there's so many different companies out there doing much the same thing, but variations on a theme, using different types of products, different types of plastics, different types of chemistries that make different types of adhesives and end closures and so on and so forth, you know? Yeah, sitting on those types of those boards it was fabulous and such a learning to go into the factories and see them crank out all this stuff, you know, but more fun to see your prototype in a little box later that they end up marketing.
Yeah,
you don't get any royalties out of it, but boy, you step back and say, yeah, I had something to do with that convex wafer system.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Is that part of what inspired you? Your most recent project?
Yeah, our ostomy exhibit, Innovations in Ostomy Care. No, that had nothing to do with that. No, that inspiration really came from our longest reigning enterostomal therapist in Canada, and her name is Diane Gard. Diane was the third enterostomal therapist. She was a layperson. She was one of the originals who had undergone surgery, and I know she wouldn't mind me sharing this. Diane had a habit of saving stuff. And she and I laugh, and we've written some articles about this. But when I finally went to her house, there were duffel bags full of these ostomy products. And she kept saying to me, as I had left the presidency for our association back in 2008, she kept saying to me, you know, what am I going to do with all this stuff? What am I going to do? And I said, honestly, Diane, I have no idea what you're going to do with this. Quite frankly, nobody wants them except you, you know. And organizations didn't exist. Like the Canadian Nurses Association does not have a facility to store and put on display nursing patient care artifacts. In 2012, and I was working at Mount Sinai, Diane approached me again and she says, well, what can we do? What can we do? So I thought about it. And I said, well, what if we put together a small little exhibit somewhere? Maybe Mount Sinai, since, you know, they're the number one hospital in Canada for bowel surgery. Anyway, long story short, out of the thousands of products that she had, we identified about 30 products, which start from the 1920s to present day. And each product is a representation of innovation in ostomy care at that time. So, you know, we went from hard rubbers to the lightweight plastic odor-proof to elastic bands and metal clamps to Velcro trademark closures. So we selected products through the decades that best demonstrated the evolution of ostomy care. And my daughter at the time had just graduated from anthropology with a specialization in archaeology. And with her specialized certificate in museum management and curatorship.
Oh, that's handy.
It's very handy. So we brought my daughter, Brenna, on board. She actually helped us to plot out a historical pathway of all of these products. So I'm happy to have collaborated with Diane. She's a dear friend and colleague, and have finally been able to move her dream forward. And it is now a beautiful presentation. Mm-hmm. And it's at the entrance to the Zane Cohn Center for Digestive Disease at Mount Sinai Hospital. So that when you walk right in, it's right there.
It's great.
Pictures. Did you get a chance to finally see it?
It looks awesome. I enjoyed it a lot.
But there's still another chapter to that.
Yeah, you're going to put it on the web, right?
And we're now going to put it on the web. It's going to be housed at the Nurses Specialized in Wound Ostomy Care Canada, their website.
So, Catherine, as you mentioned, you worked in a leadership role at Mount Sinai, where I also work. So I had the chance to see you in action, your inspiring leadership skills. Can you just tell me a bit about what you learned from nursing leadership, how you inspired practice change, how you engaged nurses to take some of these ideas of practice that have evolved from your role as research and in leadership and get them to the bedside and to direct care to patients?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that I never thought myself to be a leader. Yes, I know. But I guess I have been. I think for me, one must be extremely passionate about what you believe in. Because for me, without the passion, I'll not have the drive. Without the passion, I won't be able to look at somebody else's face and convince them to come on board. Taking risks, knowing that they're risks, that's okay. What's the worst that could possibly happen? Nothing. But if you don't recognize that there's risks, and if you don't take the opportunity to embrace some of those risks, then you'll never know, will you? Mm-mm. You'll never know. So until somebody ever says to me, "No, Catherine, absolutely not. You cannot do it," I'll still be kind of sitting back saying, "Yeah, but why?"
Good for you.
But why? Really tell me why. Okay, so beyond that, you have to have a vision. And to get those people on board, I have to be able to see it, maybe even feel it, but I have to be able to have that vision and be able to convey it to those people who I want to follow, to come on board, to be part of the process. If I can't articulate it, then I'm not ready. You can't institute the change. I mean, I think anything that I've embraced and wanting to change, I believe I've led with passion. I've had a vision. I could draw it. I could speak to it. And hopefully, you, the recipient, could start to feel of it. If I can excite you just a bit, then I think I've got you. And then I just keep drawing you in and drawing you in and drawing you in. But the other part of leadership, I think, is absolutely paramount, is that for the potential followers, for the potential engagers, they need to know that they truly can be part of the process. You need to recognize their strengths. You need to recognize why they want to be part of it. And I can think of a few examples. You know, I remember one that comes to mind. There was a colleague working on the board of an association with me, and she had an incredible mind. Like she could see through stuff and target right to the source of the problem. She was able to pull things apart and make it so clear. I mean, clearer than I was ever able to do. And yet there was a part of her that was a little rough and tough and a little negative and sometimes a little bit of a blocker. But knowing that I had this project, I thought she would be the absolute best person in the world to take this on. If I hadn't stopped for a moment to recognize her true value and the way she thought and how she could articulate the complex into something very simple, I would have lost that opportunity. And quite frankly, the association would have lost that opportunity. And so I asked her point blank, you know what? I think you would be great for this job. She looked at me and she said, yes, I think I would. And I said, great, it's yours. You take it and run with it. And she was the best ever in that position. So I'm going back to knowing who you're working with and their individual, their gifts, their talents, their strengths. And, you know, my weaknesses, their weaknesses. And those weaknesses are always potential opportunities. But, yeah, you have to be stroking. You have to be educating those followers all along. You do that and they're with you right to the goal line. There's no question about that. But it has to be fun too, you know.
It does.
It has to be fun.
And interesting.
Yeah, it has to be interesting. Or if it's not really interesting, think of a way of trying to make it interesting. You have to be a strategist.
I think you're a major proponent for nursing and the value of nursing as well. I think that resonates strongly with the people around you.
Well, I think that's going to be your ultimate goal somewhere out there, right? You're doing all of this for that ultimate goal, for the profession, for making things better, to make work life better, but again, ultimately better for the patient, right? Mm-hmm.
For somebody who is interested in improving their skills and getting better at the way that they help patients and support patients anticipating and living with an ostomy, any resources you can recommend? Programs, educational programs?
Yeah, I mean, I would start right at the bedside, and that would be encouraging anybody to seek either through their manager or their educator, whatever, time spent with a clinician who's already specializing. And whether it's in ostomy care or it's an oncology practice or, you know, whatever, is the resources are right there.
So true.
Right there, looking at you, working with you. Seek those out. Even if it is not for the almighty dollar, because not all riches come with the dollar sign. But even if it means you entertain the notion that you are going to come in with permission, you know, for a few days or a few hours to learn something, or ask to go down to the OR, or ask to be part of an outpatient clinic, that's not rocket science.
You just
have to organize to do it.
I think that
you have to want to do it.
Great point. I think
we have to
most of us are ready to educate each other. We do it with students all the time. We do it with patients.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily think to ask our colleagues for that opportunity.
Exactly.
I think that's a
so
great point.
So just formalize it a bit.
Yeah.
That's all. I remember doing that at St. Joe's when I was working there, and we introduced a program where the nurses who were working that day got permission to come down to my outpatient clinic and actually see their patient on follow-up. So they would be part of the follow-up assessment with me, but they could actually see their patient 3-4 weeks, maybe 2 months after the fact.
That's
great feedback from the nurses on that. And it was just a simple thing. It just took a little bit of organizing. That's all. So that's one resource. So the other is And, you know, yes, there are books, and yes, there are websites, but there are conferences that are offered from other hospitals, perhaps, mm-hmm. other agencies. There are national conferences. One has to want to learn. One has to want to better themselves as a person and better themselves as a professional. So it's all out there. It's all out there. You just have to ask. Ask for it.
Is there a particular journal that you used to follow?
The best one, and no bias, although I was the first editor for the Canadian feature on that, is the Journal of Wound Ostomy Continence Nursing, affectionately known as JWOCN. It is one of the best journals in wound ostomy incontinence that there is internationally. High-level research articles, clinical corners, qualitative research, a great resource. And nurse specialists in ostomy care who have the journal, you know, and you're working with them, just ask them to borrow the journal, you know. All you have to do is that.
There's also the Rachel Flood Ostomy Education Program,
which
you developed.
Oh, yes, there is that. Yeah,
Catherine,
there is that. Yeah.
As a graduate, it is extremely valuable.
Oh, very good. You graduated from that, did you?
Yes, I did.
Congratulations.
You taught me.
Well done. Did I? I can't remember that. See, time flies. 5 years. Oh, my God. My gray cells are beginning to flounder.
It was fabulous.
That's great. Yeah, that was quite a venture. Yeah, it had a great academic and clinical component. I believe it. Still operational. It's expanded, I believe.
I think it's offered through the Michener Institute
and
now.
Yes. As I was departing, our final objective was to align with University of Toronto. And we were successful in doing that. And if I recall, I've been hearing that I think it's been successful now in receiving some international students.
I think so.
Yeah.
Because they come through our unit to
do their clinical placement. Oh. Yeah. Very good.
Well, Catherine, it has been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. Do you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, but thank you so much for pulling me out of retirement for these moments to reminisce.
Well, thank you for joining me here at the bedside.
And thank you for listening. More content is coming on a variety of topics. You can visit the website at thebedside.ca or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. At the Bedside Podcast is on Instagram and Twitter, so you can connect with me there. And please rate or comment. Help amplify the voices of nurses whose perspectives on health and healthcare are so valuable today. And honestly, unlike almost all of the documentation you did today, somebody is actually going to read it. This episode was created with support from the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario Advanced Clinical Fellowship Program and Sinai Health System. All views expressed are entirely my own, and thank you, as always, to the incredible nurses and staff of the 14th floor.